Michelle, what inspired you to write this novel, The Book of Strange New Things?
It was inspired by a lot of things. I don't know if inspired is the right term, really. I got very fed up with the human race in the wake of the Afghan and Iraqi adventures in the early 2000s, and went into one of those extended sulks where I really loathed human beings and the evil that they foster. So I fantasized about writing a book that was set entirely among an alien population on another planet, so that I wouldn't have to be dealing with human beings and their dysfunctions.
So the original version, there would be no humans at all in the story?
Exactly. A novel totally without humans, which obviously is not viable. I couldn't possibly have written such a novel, but it did survive to some extent into The Book of Strange New Things, in that you have this genuinely alien race. I mean, they aren't Babylon 5 type aliens who are just human beings with a prosthetic, you know. They are genuinely non-human, and they do not think as humans do.
Right.
So that fed into the book. Also, I had become worried that my level of skill as a novelist had reached the point where I wasn't sufficiently out of control. I know that sounds odd, but I felt that I had developed skill to the point where I was a puppet master, really. I was just pulling the strings, and I felt that for a novel to be truly alive, it needs to have some chaos elements in it. It needs to have things in it that the writer, him or herself, doesn't understand.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, just for your own sort of creative urges, you had to go out of your own comfort zone.
Exactly. I mean, all of my books have been about going out of my comfort zone. I wanted each of them to be a whole new challenge. So I felt that with this book, I should take a journey into the dark. So instead of planning out the book and knowing what was going to happen in the various chapters, the way I did with, for example, The Crimson Petal and The White, I would go on this journey with my character, Peter, and would not know who he would meet, how things would pan out when he met them, and that would allow me to function more instinctively, so I would be surprised at the things that popped up in the narrative. And that, of course, meant that I had to write everything in full Technicolor. I couldn't just sketch. I had to write each chapter completely sort of publication ready, so that I had lived through that experience along with my characters in order to know what would come next for them.
That's fascinating. I mean, and this is, I don't think this is the way that novelists usually work. I mean, don't novelists usually have a sketch for how the story will unfold?
I think different novelists work in different ways, and I'm sure that the journey into the dark that I took is a journey that many other novelists have taken. It's just not a way that I had written novels before. But what happened then when I had written several chapters in this manner was that my wife, Eva, got diagnosed with an incurable cancer, multiple myeloma, cancer of the bone marrow. And that is a universally fatal cancer. And we knew that she did not have long to live. And she did actually live 6 years, which was not bad, given that a lot of people die within 3 months. But it was a very stressful time, obviously. And in the latter years, I was her carer. I was caring for her at home. And that meant that a novel of this kind, where the writer goes off into their sanctum sanctorum and conjures narrative out of nothing, you know, out of a completely blank space, I just found it impossible. And it looked for a long time as if this book would be a casualty of this terrible thing that befell us, and that it would never get finished. But in the end, my wife, who loved this book and worked on it a lot with me, implored me to to stick at it and made me promise to write 6 lines a day, which I did. And for a long time, I wrote only 6 lines a day, which, of course, at that rate, I would never have finished the book either. Yeah. But, you know, in the end, I got some momentum, and the book ended up being finished in her lifetime, and she helped me with it. She was always my first reader and, in some ways, best editor.
You're talking, but I mean, what you're describing then is a book that has these two elements. I mean, you know, it's partly set on another planet, so there's this whole kind of sort of alien theme, but you're also working through your own grief. And we should say that one of the storylines in the book is this married couple who are separated by vast distances. I mean, the one is on Earth and the other is off on this distant planet.
Yes. When I conceived the book, of course, I had no idea that it would end up being a kind of elegy for Eva and, you know, dealing with the loss of her and with her loss of her own body, because her cancer, you know, really brought home the vulnerability of the human body in the same way that the book, you know, deals with these issues, without wanting to utter too many spoilers here. It ended up being prophetic, if you like.
Prophetic of a loss. Prophetic in what way?
Well, when I conceived the book, I didn't know that I would lose either. I knew that the book would be about loss and about valuing this marvelous gift that we are given, you know, these bodies that we are privileged to inhabit. But I didn't know what was going to befall Eva, and I didn't know that enormous distance that is between Peter and Bea, the characters in the book, that would be echoed metaphorically in the distance that is between a healthy person and his loved one who is living on planet Cancer and who, you know, I couldn't follow her there. She had already traveled there, and she was very, very far away in that sense.
Yeah. We should back up for a moment and talk some about the basic outline of the story. Can you give us a sort of a brief synopsis?
Yes, it's. I mean, I'm always wary about what the Americans rightly call spoilers. I think that serious literary fiction is often too little respectful of the joys of discovering plot elements which are meant to be, you know, thrilling reveals. And I certainly don't consider myself above all that. I think that's one of the wonderful things about reading. So that does make it a bit difficult. But
well, set us up. Tell us who Peter Lee is.
Peter Lee is an ex-alcoholic, well, alcoholic still, I guess, and ex-drug addict, who has been rescued from his former lifestyle by a woman called Bea, who he ends up marrying, and they are both very devoted Christians. He becomes a Christian minister with a parish in England. And there's a shadowy organization called USIC. We never find out what USIC stands for. And they have established a colony. Well, actually, we're not allowed to call it a colony. It's a community, they keep emphasizing. We do not use the word colony. They've established a community on an alien planet called Oasis. And the native population of this planet, the indigenous creatures, want a Christian minister to bring them the word of God. So Peter passes a very rigorous sort of entrance exam to figure out whether he can survive in this very special environment on Oasis. And his wife evidently fails the entrance exam. So she has to stay home on Earth, and he goes off to Oasis. And initially we imagine that he's going to have a very, very difficult mission with lots of things going wrong and having to solve many, many problems, and that she will be having a much more boring time on humdrum planet Earth. But in fact, the way it pans out is that while he is away, things on Earth take a very bad turn in terms of natural disasters and social breakdown and so on.
Typhoons, and earthquakes, food shortages, yes, all that.
Sure. Corporations going bust that people thought were too big to fail and so on. And she's dealing with all that. And he is on this faraway planet having actually a quite marvelous time ministering to this native population who adore him and who are hungry for the word of God.
Yeah. So he's a missionary. He's a missionary, yes, off to spread the word of Jesus.
Yes.
You have a wonderful description of what these aliens first looked like when Peter first sees one. And could you give us a taste of that? Could you read a passage?
I'd be happy to. Right. The creature, the person, stood upright, but not tall. 5'3", maybe 5'4". Funny how those imperial measurements, inches, miles, stubbornly refused to be left behind. Anyway, he or she was delicate, small-boned, narrow-shouldered, an unassuming presence, not at all the awesome figure Peter had prepared himself to confront. As foretold, a hood and monkish robes, made of a pastel blue fabric, disconcertingly like bath towel, covered almost all of the body, its hems brushing the toes of soft leather boots. There was no swell of bosom, so Peter, aware that this was flimsy evidence on which to base a judgment, but unwilling to clutter his brain with unwieldy repetitions of he or she, decided to think of the creature as male. "Hi," said Granger, extending her hand. The Oasen extended his hand in return, but did not grasp Granger's. Rather, he touched her gently on the wrist with his fingertips. He was gloved. The gloves had 5 digits. "You here now," he said. "A surprise." His voice was soft, reedy, asthmatic sounding. Where the S's should have been, there was a noise like a ripe fruit being thumbed into 2 halves. "Not a bad surprise, I hope," said Granger.
"I hope together with you."
The Oasen turned to look at Peter, tilted his head slightly so that the shadows from the hood slid back. Peter, having been lulled by the Oasen's familiar shape and 5-fingered hands into expecting a more or less human face, flinched. Here was a face that was nothing like a face. Instead, it was a massive whitish-pink walnut kernel. Or no, even more, it resembled a placenta with 2 fetuses, maybe 3-month-old twins, hairless and blind, nestled head to head, knee to knee. Their swollen heads constituted the Oasen's clefted forehead, so to speak. Their puny ribbed backs formed his cheeks. Their spindly arms and webbed feet merged in a tangle of translucent flesh that might contain, in some form unrecognizable to him, a mouth, nose, eyes. Of course, there were no fetuses there, not really. The face was what it was, the face of an Oasen, nothing else. But try as he might, Peter couldn't decode it on its own terms. He could only compare it to something he knew. He had to see it as a grotesque pair of fetuses perched on someone's shoulders, half shrouded in a cowl. Because if he didn't allow it to resemble that, he would probably always have to stare at it dumbfounded, reliving the initial shock, dizzy with the vertigo of unsupported falling, in that gut-wrenching instant before a solid comparison is found to clasp onto.
Oh, what a vivid description. That is wonderful. So what you're doing, I mean, you're creating an alien race that is to some degree unfathomable to humans.
Sure, sure. I think one of the ways in which science fiction often works is that aliens are used as a way of shedding new light or additional insight into the way humans work. And in that sense, they are just standing in for humans of various types. I wanted to create an alien race that was truly alien in every respect.
Why? I mean, why did you want to explore that kind of alien?
Well, a lot of my work deals with alienation as such, the gulf between us and the other. I mean, Under the Skin, a novel of mine set in Scotland, which was recently made into a film by Jonathan Glazer, with Scarlett Johansson playing the Isili character. That was about the way we give ourselves permission to mistreat others as soon as we label them the other. In the case of that novel, it was the alien classifying humans as a kind of animal and therefore could be treated as we treat animals. But in all my work, I'm looking at the way we are different species from each other. I mean, you and whoever you're in the studio with are both human beings, or I don't know if there's a number of you there. But in another way, you are very different creatures from each other, and you are inhabiting your own universe, your own planet. And I'm very mindful of that when I'm relating to other people. And of course, I'm also mindful of it. I don't know how political your program is permitted to be.
We can get political, yeah.
Well, I'm very mindful that as a species, we're capable of mounting multi-trillion dollar invasions of other countries in which we are attempting to effect regime change or kill people that we don't approve of or whatever our agenda is supposedly is. But we do this without actually speaking the language of the people that we are supposedly helping or killing. And we actually have no idea how their minds work because we are alien from them. And, you know, on a metaphorical level, I'm always finding new ways to deal with that huge remove between us and the other in my books.
So I'm really interested in the fact that at least a couple of your novels are very explicitly science fiction. Do you consider yourself working within the science fiction tradition? I mean, are you sort of drawing on the tropes of science fiction?
I'm very wary of taking the snobbish novelist, snobbish sort of serious literary novelist stance of saying, well, of course I use some of the tropes of science fiction in my work, but I would never read such material myself. There's an awful lot of snobbishness among literary writers about genre fiction. And even though I don't read genre fiction anymore. I read an enormous amount of genre fiction when I was younger. I read lots of romances and sci-fi books and thrillers and all the rest of it. So, I enjoyed them and I absorbed a lot from them. And I think that one of the things that literary fiction has to learn from genre fiction is that there are certain kinds of thrills and narrative hooks and literally awesome experiences, awesome in the sense of promoting awe, that you can get from these genres like science fiction. And I try to incorporate all of those into my books. And if someone wants to classify a book like The Book of Strange New Things as science fiction, I'm quite happy with that. I'm not going to jump through semantic hoops and say, no, you're wrong. It's actually literary fiction or it's speculative or, you know, whatever the acceptable term is. If someone wants to see it as science fiction, that's fine. My only concern is that I wouldn't want people who don't read science fiction to be turned off my book thinking that it's going to be about spaceships or people firing ray guns or,
Right.
the whole Babylon 5 thing, because A, they would be extremely disappointed because my book doesn't deliver any of that. It's very much character driven. It's very much about human emotion and philosophical issues. So I wouldn't want to disappoint them. And also, you know, I wouldn't want the book to be stored in the part of the bookstore where the Star Trek adaptations are stored, because that would mean that the people who might very much enjoy my book wouldn't go into that part of the bookstore.
Right.
So it's a tricky issue for me. I mean, how did you feel when you were reading it? Did you feel that it was science fiction? How did you classify it?
Yes, I would, but to me that's not a negative. It's not just consigned as, oh, you know, we shouldn't take that seriously. But absolutely, I would consider this science fiction.
Yeah, I mean, some of my favorite books when I was younger were science fiction books, and they are a hell of a lot more sparky and philosophically interesting than many of the books that win prestigious literary prizes, which, truth be told, can be very, very dull.
Yeah. Well, let me follow up on this, because, I mean, partly what you're doing here is, I mean, this is a novel of ideas, among other things. And one of the things you're doing is you are exploring language. And you have, to some degree, created a language that this alien race, the Oasens, speak. And in fact, it would be great to get a taste of that. Could you read us a passage that illustrates how you deal with language?
Well, the book actually has an alien typography for the particular letters that the Oasens simply cannot pronounce because they don't have vocal cords. They don't have tongues, whatever it is that's required to make those sounds.
And so they have they have a hard time saying certain sounds that we use in English, for instance, S's.
Yes, exactly. So, and also, of course, there are many concepts that they're not familiar with. So one of Peter's tasks is to paraphrase the Bible stories, not just in ways that avoid the S's and T's and CH sounds that the Oasens have trouble with, but also that avoid concepts that are alien to them, like sheep and lambs and by the riverside and all those things that occur in the Bible. So he has this impossible task of paraphrase, which gives the book some much-needed humor, I think, because it is a very, very sad book. But I will have to try my best to say the unsayable when I read this passage. Granger, stiff with unease, walked to the rear of the vehicle to stow the tub back in the trunk. As soon as her back was turned, the Oasen sidled up to Peter, bringing them face to face. "Have you the book?"
"The book?"
"The book of strange new things." Peter blinked and tried to breathe normally. Up close, the Oasen's flesh smelled sweet. Not the sweet of rot, but sweet like fresh fruit.
"You mean the Bible?" he said.
"We speak never the name. Power of the book forbid. Flame give warmth."
With outstretched hands, he mimed the action of warming oneself on a fire, getting too close and being burned.
"But you mean the Word of God," said Peter, "the Gospel." "The Gospel, the technique of Jesus."
Peter nodded, but it was a moment before he decoded the last word from its impeded passage through the Oasen's head cleft.
"Jesus," he echoed in wonder.
The Oasen reached out one hand and, with an unmistakably tender motion, stroked Peter's cheek with the tip of a glove.
"We pray, Jesus, for your coming," he said.
Granger's failure to rejoin them was by now obvious. Peter glanced round and saw her leaning on the back of the vehicle, pretending to study the gadget with which she'd unlocked the trunk. In that fraction of a second before he turned back to the Oasen, he felt the full intensity of her embarrassment.
"The book. You have the book?"
the Oasen repeated. Not on me right now," said Peter, chastising himself for leaving his Bible back at the base. "But yes, of course, of course." The Oasen clapped his hands in a gesture of delight, or prayer, or both.
"Comfort and joy. Glad day. Come back soon, Peter. Oh, very soon. Sooner than you can. Read for us the book of strange new things. Read and read and read until we understand. In reward we give you.
The Oasen trembled with the effort of finding adequate words, then threw his hands wide, as if to indicate everything under the sun. Yes, said Peter. Is that...
If you want to just wrap up at that, we'd be fine. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, you said was a smile. We can wrap it up there if you feel that that's
appropriate. No, go ahead and read those last two paragraphs. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yes, said Peter, laying a reassuring hand on the Oasen's shoulder. Soon. The Oasen's brow, the heads of the fetuses, so to speak, swelled slightly. Peter decided that this, in these miraculous new people, was a smile.
That is wonderful. And I have to say, you have taken the
first time I've read that.
The whole art of an author reading in a whole new direction. Saying almost the unpronounceable.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know whether I was going to be able to do that, but it has been premiered on your show.
There you go. Yeah, no. I don't think anyone else could actually read this book out loud. I think you have to do it.
Well, there was an avant-garde musician that I've actually been collaborating with. I don't know if you're aware of a band called Nurse with Wound.
No.
No, it's avant-garde British band. And he's a member of this band. And he set up some electronic equipment, which I was to operate with a foot pedal, so that every time I had to read a sibilant, you know, mm-hmm. in the Oasen voice, I could press the foot pedal and it would distort. And I tried it, but it sounded a bit like Darth Vader, you know. So in the end, I figured that I would just have to busk it. I'd just have to do it with my own voice, for good or ill.
For good. No, you do it wonderfully. One of the other ideas that you were exploring here, which I would think must be fascinating for a novelist to kind of dive into, is the whole idea of how Christianity would be received on another planet, and the Bible. I mean, that's, you know, your... Mm. This alien race, where the story would seem to be totally different. Why did you want to go there?
I've always been fascinated by issues of faith. For those of your listeners who've read The Crimson Petal and The White, there's two characters in that book called Henry and Emmeline who are very devout Christians. And I don't take the mickey out of them. I take them very seriously, and I actually love them, genuinely love them. And a novella of mine called The Fire Gospel, which is sort of a piss take. Can we say that on your program?
Yeah, that's okay.
A sort of piss take of the Da Vinci Code is, again, dealing with issues of religion, in this case an hitherto undiscovered gospel, which is translated from the Aramaic and has a certain effect on the modern world. And again, in this book, I'm looking at religious faith. But in this book, there really is very little satire. It's played very straight. I myself am not a Christian, and I don't regard that as a badge of honor. I actually regard that as a tragedy, because it's... It is scary to live in a universe where there is no one looking after us and where we are just parcels of meat that flourish for a brief time and then rot. It's a big hole in the fabric of the universe when we really truly intuit that is the way things are. And I wanted in this book to look at the consolation that faith
can give to people who are having to endure the unendurable.
It's almost as if you are reinventing the idea of religion by putting it on a new planet, in a sense creating a new religion, even though it is Christianity, but it has to sort of be remade.
Sure. I actually read, there's a scene early on in the novel when we haven't seen Peter being particularly competent. He's been very sort of jet-lagged from his journey to the alien planet, and he's said a lot of the wrong things in conversations with people. And we're wondering, you know, whether he really is cut out for this mission. And then he is given the job at very short notice of conducting a funeral service for someone he hardly knows. And he does a magnificent job. It's a terrific sermon that he delivers. And I read that piece out, that scene, to David Mitchell, the author of Cloud Atlas and The Bone Clocks, who was visiting our house at that time. I mean, Eva was still alive. And he told me very charmingly that if there was anything that could give him religious faith, you know, that could turn him into a Christian, it would be that scene in my novel that would do the trick for him.
Actually, I just talked with David Mitchell recently, you know, exploring some of his metaphysical ideas about the bone
yes.
clocks. So, yeah. There's a bit of news that has come out since your book has been published. You have said that this is your last novel. You will never write another novel, which has kind of shocked a lot of your fans. Why?
I knew when I was writing The Fire Gospel that it was the second last novel. And I knew when I started this one that it was the last. Now, my wife was very, very upset at that notion that I wouldn't write any more novels. She made me promise not to talk about that in interviews. Basically, she had a never-say-never attitude. And it was a matter of grief for her, the notion that I would stop. But that was before she was diagnosed, and the novel, as you know, ended up being a kind of farewell to her, and also ended up being, in some senses, a farewell to novel writing. It's a farewell to so many things. And I felt that it's a valedictory novel. It's an appropriate last one. I wanted all of my books to be radically different from each other. I wanted them to be so different from each other that you could almost not recognize that the author of one could possibly have written the other. And I could only pull that off, you know, so many times before my limitations kick in and before I would be repeating myself. And I think I've pulled it off as often as I could. I never wanted to be the sort of author who puts out books because that's my job. You know, 2 years have gone by, it's about time another Michelle Faber book came on the market. I feel it's a satisfactory body of work. There's also a lot of short stories which most people have not investigated, particularly in the USA. I'm not saying that this is my game plan to force readers to investigate the short stories by depriving them of any more novels. But it has been remarkable to me when I, for example, talk to people in signing queues when they've been getting their Crimson Petal and the White signed. And they've said to me, oh, we're desperate to know what happened to Sugar and the various characters in the Crimson Petal. Could you write a sequel? And I say to them, well, actually, I'm not a sequel kind of guy. I would never write a sequel. But I have written this book of short stories called The Apple, which looks at the various characters from The Crimson Petal at different times in their lives. And these people's eyes just glaze over. You know, they drift away from the signing table. They are not interested because it is short stories. Hmm. And they have categorized themselves as novel readers. And, you know, maybe with any luck, if there are no more novels, these people might eventually investigate the short story collections, which I'm immensely proud of. I love the short story form. And another reason why I feel that it's the last, writing novels was something that I very much shared with Eva. She was very involved with the reading and the editing of them, the feedback, and I would hand over the novels chapter by chapter and we would discuss them. And she has died, and that era is over. And I don't feel right about doing that without her. I think I will write some more short stories, and perhaps in time there might be enough for another collection, which will then, you know, again be ignored by the mass readership. Eva left behind quite a lot of unfinished short stories of her own, and I might decide to collaborate with her posthumously on those, depending on whether I can do her voice justice. I'm writing a lot of poetry about the grieving process at the moment. That is the thing that I'm writing. And I think those things should keep me busy, probably, for the life that I have left.
Hmm. Well, was writing this novel cathartic in any way? I mean, dealing with your wife's death? I mean, the fact that really during the whole course of writing it, she was in the act of dying.
I'm not convinced that writing is cathartic for anyone. I think sometimes writers convince themselves that writing a particular book has helped them work through various things, but it may just be the passage of time. Because, of course, it takes a long time to write a book, and time is passing, and your grief is therefore being processed on some level. So I don't know. I mean, one of the advantages, if you want to use that awful word, about the particular kind of cancer that Eva had, is that we had a long time to say goodbye. We knew what was coming. We knew that it was inevitable. It was an immensely intimate time. It was very, very tender. It was awful, of course, but intimate and tender. And we said everything to each other that we needed to say. So there was no unfinished business there, if you like. So in that sense, I already did. We both, we grieved together. She grieved for the life that she was about to lose and the body that she was losing. And I grieved in anticipation of the loss of her. So a lot of that was already happening beforehand. I don't know what role the book played in that. I rather doubt that it was terribly important. But what was important was that I finished it, because that meant a lot to her. She loved the book, and she was very involved in its honing, if you like. So that's a matter of consolation to me.
Yeah, I can hardly imagine what it would have been like to write this, given what you were going through. One last thing, I'm just sort of curious about, in your acknowledgments, at the end of the book, you talk about some of the writers and artists at Marvel Comics during the 1960s and 70s for the enjoyment that you gave, that they gave you as a child and since then, and you single out Jack Kirby, who was one of the most influential comic book creators. Did Jack Kirby have an influence on this novel?
I think he had an influence in the sense that what I got from Kirby's 1960s stuff, when he was literally creating new universes on a weekly and monthly basis. It was astonishing, the fertility of his brain, and fueled by nothing more psychedelic than cigars. So all these extraordinary narrative ecosystems that he made up for the Fantastic Four and the whole Fourth World series for DC Comics and so on, it instilled in me a sense of wonder when I was a kid. And I think that created in me the expectation that when I encountered narrative, I should expect to be awed. I should expect to encounter something wondrous. And that made me far less likely to write novels in which middle-aged guys based on myself deal with midlife crisis type issues, you know, while getting divorced, blah, blah, blah. It's not that kind of mundane navel-gazing writing is something that I was probably inoculated against by the expectations that my love of Kirby's stuff in particular fostered in me. In terms of specific influence on this book, I mean, the pastor who preceded Peter Lee on this planet, who has disappeared in mysterious circumstances, is called Marty Kurtzberg. And, you know, in the novel you find out what became of him. But obviously his name Kurtzberg is based on Jack Kirby's original Jewish name, Jacob Kurtzberg. It's also a reference or an allusion to Colonel Kurtz in Heart of Darkness, which is another narrative that flows underneath the Book of Strange New Things. And it's a reference to Kurtz, the Brando character, in Apocalypse Now, the Coppola film, another narrative that flows underneath the Book of Strange New Things. So the whole Kurtzberg element is very resonant for me.
It is a remarkable world that you have created here. Thank you for talking about it with us.
It's a pleasure.